As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Let's go, man. Tear it up, dude.
You're listening to Here's the Catch with David Lombardi and Matt Barrows on the Athletic Podcast Network.
49ers, Here's the Catch. The podcast is back. The 49ers are 1-0. They beat Pittsburgh 30-7. Dominant win. David Lombardi here, Matt Barrows on the other end of the line. Matt, we are both out in Pittsburgh. And, you know, my main takeaway here is that the 49ers have a lower burden of proof than a lot of teams in the league, because they've been to three out of the past four NFC title games. They're a known commodity. A lot of teams will do something in week one, and I'll say, hey, it's only week one. But if the 49ers look like what the 49ers are supposed to look like in week one, there's some weight behind that, right? Because they've already performed at this high level. To me, the way that I saw them perform at Pittsburgh, that was mid-season form just a little bit earlier in the year. And for a team who is putting such a great weight and such importance on coming out of the gate fast, it's a big deal.
Yeah, and I think they looked a lot like they did in training camp too. I mean, think of what our training camp themes were. They were how good Ayuk and Christian McCaffrey looked. I mean, those guys were super consistent throughout the summer. How dominant the D-line was, and that was a little bit more evident early on. And there wasn't any Bosa in the mix there. And then the other theme that we wrote about a lot was Brock Purdy and how he looked right from the get-go, like, you know, he did before his injury. And that got a little stronger throughout as all the restrictions were kind of taken away from him. And all four of those things shone through. And that was good. I could add Jake Moody to that mix. I mean, that was the one thing that didn't ring true in the preseason. Jake Moody wasn't good in the preseason, and he was really good, really consistent in the training camp practices that we saw. So he was true to form as well. So, I mean, it was exactly what if you watched all, I forget how many training camp practices there were. That's what you would have expected, and that's what you got. There were really very few surprises, and there are some bad things, and we could talk about that as well. But it was mostly good, and they mostly adhered to their strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that you talk about complementary football. That's something that every team strives to play, but few actually attain it. And usually a team has to go on a true hot streak. They have to build a certain rhythm within a season to play it. The fact that the 49ers played it right out of the gate with the offense controlling possession, the defense completely snuffing out Pittsburgh's possessions. That was five straight drives that were three and outs to open the game. And then with the special teams not screwing it up. I mean, that's all the 49ers need when their offense and their defense is playing that well. If the special teams can just hold serve, they're in business, right? And this football team can see the different phases of the game feed off of each other. I think that we have to start with Brock Purdy because big picture, several months ago, people were doubting that he'd be available for this game. They saw 6 months as the prognosis. the estimate from the time of his surgery, and they said, well, 6 months, that's just about exactly the season opener. I think it was March 10th surgery, and obviously the season opener in Pittsburgh was on September 10th. Brock Purdy was not only ready to go for the season opener, he was ready to go for the start of training camp, and he might have been ready to go even if training camp started a little earlier. On top of that, he passed every single psychological barrier that comes with a return from injury, stepped out onto that field in Pittsburgh, and played great. Not just good, he played great. He actually leads the NFL in QBR after week one. Jimmy Garoppolo is also in the top five, and so is Matthew Stafford. Number two is the Rams quarterback, Matthew Stafford. So that sets the table for next week against the Rams. You're going to have number one and number two QBR from week one, but the 49ers certainly have to be over the moon with how good Brock Purdy has looked, even better than last year. I thought he did a couple things that were weaknesses last season. We could talk about those in a bit, but I thought that he corrected those in this game against the Steelers, Matt.
Yeah, that leads us to a nice question from a reader. Wills D said, long season, but after this game, what do you guys think about camp interceptions? Do they matter? And what was the number, 11, David, for Brock Purdy this summer?
Yeah, 10 or 11. I mean, they matter. Yes, of course. Everything matters. Everything matters, but it matters within context. I mean, the problem is that people are just counting interceptions and saying, oh, he's throwing too many interceptions. I mean, you have to watch these practices and talk to people and figure out, okay, what's Brock Purdy doing here? What's he working on here? Who made a nice play there? Oh, that was a tipped interception. Maybe that shouldn't count against the total. I mean, stuff just doesn't happen in a vacuum. And I think people got way too carried away with the total interceptions instead of considering the fact that Kyle Shanahan wanted Brock Purdy to push the limit a little bit in training camp. And you never should consider training camp to be something that supersedes actual game tape. In actual game tape last year, Brock Purdy did not throw too many interceptions. He had a good INT rate. It wasn't great, but it was solid. So if you had all that game tape to go off of, why were people so obsessed with training camp? It makes no sense to me, right? So it matters, but people just didn't prioritize it correctly in their heads, and they made it a much bigger thing than it had to be.
Yeah, I think a lot of people recall his 2022 games and thought that maybe the low interception rate was a bit of a mirage, or he got lucky, because there were some passes that he absolutely got lucky with that were dropped by defenders. Sunday, however, I mean, there was the one pass to George Kittle that Patrick Peterson got a really nice jump on, got his hands on it, was a PBU, could have been an interception, but that was the closest I could see. He just seemed like he was in command, and that wasn't iffy at all in that game. That's the way he played in the playoffs too. There weren't very many close calls in the playoffs and against Seattle and the Cowboys, of course. So, I mean, it's almost like you could make the argument, you know, the more he plays, the more those close calls have diminished. Very, very small sample size. We'll have to wait on that. But week one was good. I mean, I would go so far as to say, you don't want to say there were no blemishes. The sack fumble, I thought that maybe he could have gotten rid of the ball when he realized that nobody was open, and, you know, Colton McKibbitz is one-on-one with T.J. Watt. That would be sort of next-level quarterbacking, 12-year veteran quarterbacking. But, to me, that was almost the extent of his errors in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and I thought that, you know, Patrick Peterson wasn't lying when he said that he might be able to jump a ball from Brock Purdy and maybe get an interception. He obviously, his prediction was incorrect because he didn't notch an interception. But I think that the tells that he was talking about on the podcast that he claimed that the 49ers and Purdy were giving off were on those intermediate passes over the middle. And that Brock Purdy's been fantastic with the middle of the field, essentially the side of the field too, between 10 and 20 yards. Air yards. Last year, there's been no quarterback on PFF's record, and that record goes back over two decades, with a higher completion percentage than Brock Purdy. In 2022, it was 80.4%. He was at 90%. He was 9 of 10 on such throws in this game. And the one incompletion was Patrick Peterson really jumping on one. I think he read that it was coming and he kind of lunged out. And I think he was either guarding Jennings or George Kittle. He had two pass breakups, one against Kittle and one against Jennings. But one of those two was on an intermediate throw that could have been an interception. It was almost a pick, but it wasn't quite there. But anyway, zooming back out, this happens to every quarterback. I mean, everybody throws picks. Nobody is immune to them at practice or in games. And what really matters is the overarching efficiency. I'll go back to your point too, Matt. Last year, PFF does a cool measurement of turnover-worthy throws, which includes the throws that a quarterback supposedly got away with. Purdy was top 10. I mean, by top 10, I mean fewest 10 in turnover-worthy throws last year, in that rate of turnover-worthy throws. So even with those factored in, he was still taking care of the ball at a better than average clip. And I think that when we have that documented, we can expect more of the same, if not better football from him. And the only real football that he put in harm's way was the one that Peterson knocked away that I was talking about. And I agree with you on the fumble. It was an issue. I mean, we could talk about the 49ers' biggest weakness. This is a team that looked like a juggernaut right out of the gate, except for the right guard and the right tackle positions in pass protection. Spencer Burford and Colton McKivitz, they're working against TJ Watt. Both of those guys had their issues, and that is something the 49ers will absolutely have to improve, Matt.
One more quarterback question. This one's from Victor K. He says, with the 49ers working out a QB, and they reportedly worked out Ian Book today, is there a chance Sam Darnold gets moved? Is Brandon Allen at risk of being dropped from the team or moved himself? My take on that is that they're not going to trade Sam Darnold, the number two quarterback, especially after a game where Brock Purdy took a pretty big hit there from TJ Watt. And it was kind of reminiscent of the Hassan Reddick hit. But I did have a bit of a question in my mind about Brandon Allen, because the Jets right now are looking for quarterbacks. And my sense is that they'd like to bring in a veteran. They've got a young guy in Zach Wilson who's going to be running the ship right now. The compliment would be more of a veteran guy. And I just wonder whether the 49ers are just kind of just looking around. I mean, if they got a really good offer for Brandon Allen, what would be their move? They would want to have a third quarterback for sure, given what happened last year. I mean, I think that the Ian Book thing is just doing due diligence, seeing what they have out there. Remember, they brought in a couple of quarterbacks last year, Ben Kurt. I forget who the other guy was, the former Washington quarterback. This is what they do during the season. So it's not out of the realm. But if they did get a good offer for Brandon Allen from some team, what would be their move for number three? Anyway, the Ian Book thing just kind of got me thinking of that, because it came in such close proximity to Aaron Rodgers getting hurt.
Yeah, and I think that's what started the rumor mill. It's worth noting they also worked out three wide receivers today, and they probably wanted a quarterback to throw to those three receivers. And I think Book is working out for New England tomorrow. So he flies across country to Boston or that area to work out for the Patriots. So he might be on kind of the workout tour. He's obviously looking to land a job. But even if there's no opening right now, these teams do this year-round. They'll bring in guys who they might not have any room for at the moment, but you got to keep the Rolodex updated, especially if you're a team like the 49ers who needed to reach into that Rolodex at the quarterback position last year. They ended up signing Josh Johnson, and Josh Johnson had a play in the NFC Championship game. So more likely than not, that's what's going on. But yes, the rumor mill did speed up today when we are dealing with the aftermath of the Aaron Rodgers injury. Zach Wilson, at the moment, the new starter for the New York Jets, and we'll see how that continues. But, you know, even the Rodgers thing illustrates the situation in the league right now that applies to the 49ers with the offensive line. That those tackles were giving up a whole heck of a lot of pressure early. It's even a little bit of a scandal now. I think that the Athletic is reporting on this. I think Diana Rossini teamed up with somebody else to write the article. I guess Aaron Rodgers didn't want his tackles cut blocking, but the Jets apparently feel that their offensive line was overmatched. So They resorted to cut blocking, which generally means the quarterback needs to get rid of the ball quickly, because if you cut block, well, the defensive end's just going to get up and he's going to have a chance to take a second shot at the quarterback. And, you know, Rodgers obviously got hit twice in that game in the very short period of time that he was in the game. So his injury, everybody's talking about the turf, and that's fine. I do believe artificial turf needs to be replaced with natural grass, but maybe the even more pressing thing to talk about right now is that the Jets did not block well for Aaron Rodgers, and other teams want to avoid that fate. And the 49ers' biggest weakness was pass protection on the right side, Matt. So I think, you know, just moving forward, we talk about player acquisitions. Maybe the offensive line needs to be at the top of that list, or at least player development week to week. The 49ers need better play from Colton McKivitz and Spencer Burford in week two.
Well, let's talk about a name that became available today. Lael Collins, the ex-Cowboy turned Cincinnati Bengal. The Bengals made him available. He's a free agent now. That's a big name at right tackle, and you don't usually see big names come available. But you have to wonder why he is available. He suffered a ACL tear. I think it was ACL, MCL tear in late December. I think it was week 16. So, you know, I don't think that there's any question that peak Lael Collins is better than what the 49ers have at right tackle, McKivitz, Matt Pryor, and Jalen Moore. But he's 30 now, and the Cowboys got rid of him for nothing a couple of years ago. The Bengals have just done the same. So, I don't know. To me, I think that they still need to see what McKivitz can do against non-TJ Watt opponents. And if he's not the answer, then, you know, they also are developing Jalen Moore and getting Matt Pryor ready to play in this offense. So I, to me, those are the next few moves that we might see, not a sort of kind of desperation move after one bad game against a really terrific opponent.
Yeah, there's absolutely no reason to be desperate right now if you're the 49ers. You knew that Colton McKivitz was going to be a work in progress, an unknown commodity that would have to break into his time at right tackle. I think everybody expected him to struggle against TJ Watt. I think you hope that he, in combination with Spencer Burford, would look a little bit better, but still, that shouldn't disrupt your process here. And the process should be, okay, how do these guys react to struggle? Are there lessons learned here, and do they apply those lessons to their week two performance and beyond? So you don't know the answer to that until after week two, until after more games are in the books for the 49ers. Now, they have given themselves the optionality moving forward to potentially make moves, and that is seen in the cap space they opened up. We haven't done a podcast since the Nick Bosa signing, so here it is. We're covering what the 49ers did with Nick Bosa and all the financial moves last week, and they essentially doubled down their commitment on their core of superstar veterans: Trent Williams, George Kittle, Eric Armstead. Yes, Eric Armstead is a star. The way that Eric Armstead played last week he opened so much up for that defensive line. Two of Drake Jackson's three sacks. Drake Jackson's dad, Dennis, told me that he thanked Gus Armstead, who's Eric Armstead's dad. Your son helped create two sacks for my son. It was that kind of situation. Anyway, 49ers doubled down their financial commitment with restructures for those players. They obviously doubled down on Nick Bosa. The bet is that those guys are going to be good for another 2 years, and preferably at least 3 years. For Bosa, they hope that he's good for another 5 years. But they opened up cap space through doing that, right? And the cap space they opened up, $42 million, is potentially going to be used to spruce up the roster this year. Last year, they were able to spruce up the roster. They were able to turbocharge it when Christian McCaffrey became available. We don't know exactly who's going to be available before the deadline this year. We don't know exactly where the 49ers' holes are going to be. I know right now it looks like they're right tackle and right guard, but that hasn't fully crystallized yet. You have to give this a couple more weeks to see where everybody's at. And then, you know, somebody else can get hurt, right, before week 7 or week 8 or whenever the trade deadline is. So right now the 49ers have that optionality in their hip pocket. They're not going to use it yet. until, you know, we know more, until they know more. But just know, Matt, that they can potentially pick somebody else up. We just don't know who's going to be available, and we don't know where that pronounced need is going to be, because these seasons can take some unpredictable twists and turns. So I think that the key point is that the 49ers have the ability at their disposal to spend more. And for a team in win-now mode, that is an important ability to have.
Well, while we're on the subject, I mean, let's just say that they rolled the entirety of that space over to 2024. Are they able to accommodate everything that they need to do with that space? You know, Bosa, a new contract for Ayuk, Deebo Samuel, George Kittle, Kyle Juszczyk, Trent Williams. Is that all feasible given the space that they have right now?
Yes. So in 2000 and in next season, Brandon Ayuk, actually, they could do the same thing with him as they did with Nick Bosa. They could make him cheaper for 2024 than he currently is slated to be with that fifth-year option. So the 49ers would be in good position there to be able to reward Brandon Ayuk. The simple math here is the 49ers, according to my projection, if it would be about $40 million over the projected 2024 salary cap, but they have $42 million right now open that could roll over, so that would cover that much. Now you're going to spend some this year, even if you don't make a big trade or a big signing. You're probably going to have to spend some of that on signings to replace players who are hurt, so on and so forth. But again, more money can open up through Ayuk, and more money, they could also start doing more restructures next year. These restructures work as long as, hey, you're willing to dispense the money sooner, right? Because it comes in the form, it doesn't come in the form of a direct signing bonus right now, but you still have to dispense the money sooner than if you're paying out a base salary over the course of 18 weeks. So if you're willing to spend, that's great. That helps. But they also work if the players that you double down on remain efficient contributors throughout the life of their contract. So you make a double down bet on guys like Armstead, on guys like Kittle, on guys like Trent Williams. Why it didn't work for the Rams, why the Rams, you know, went into cap hell, is because they started taking on huge dead money hits. And dead money hits, by definition, are inefficient, right? Guys like Brandon Cooks, who they traded. Guys like Jared Goff, who they traded. Todd Gurley, who they cut. Those were massive dead money hits that basically made the salary cap sink overflow for the Rams to where they had to cut other players like Leonard Floyd. This past off season, the 49ers, as long as they get the continued efficiency from contributors like George Kittle and Trent Williams for at least two more years, won't be in that same predicament. Now everything can go awry. Somebody like Trent Williams can decide he's not going to play anymore after this year. Yeah, then you're probably facing the music if you're the 49ers. But a bet is a bet, and you do have to gamble to win big, right? And the 49ers did gamble. Those are the players they chose to double down on. And we'll see how that wager turns out.
Let's talk about the defense. Dave D has a question, and that is, what is your assessment of Isaiah Oliver? He got into the game for a bit after not grasping the nickel job. I'm curious if your assessment of about his play this weekend. To my eye, and you know, this had a lot to do with that one 95-yard drive at the end of the first half, was that Oliver played pretty well, because he wasn't on the field in the first half. I was surprised, and I wrote about this in the mailbag that's up right now. I thought Oliver was going to be the guy in this game because Steve Wilks had said that, okay, we've got two nickels. We've got a guy who can cover big slot players and tight ends who line up in the slot. Like if the 49ers play Travis Kelce, for example, Isaiah Oliver might, you know, be tasked with covering him. And then D'Amador Lenore for smaller, shiftier guys. Well, you know, the Steelers' slot receiver is Allen Robinson, a 6'3", 220-pounder who's not all that fast. So I thought for sure that Isaiah Oliver would be the guy who played nickel in that game. That's why the 49ers signed him to a big free agency deal. But instead, it was D'Amador Lenore And, you know, which means that Ambry Thomas comes into the game, and the Steelers exploited that on that 95 yard drive. So, my thought was that Isaiah Oliver, you know, he let up some throws, I think 3 of 3 targets in the second half, but he seemed like he was in the right place. He certainly wasn't getting beaten like a drum. I thought he played well and looked confident. And of course, when he's out there, it means Diamador Lenore is in his, you know, his natural spot. He's on the outside. So to me, that's the question. No Cooper Kupp in this game coming up, David, but the Rams got good efficiency out of Kupp's backups. Nakua and, gosh, I can't remember the other guy's name, but they had really nice games in that win over the Seahawks. So I'm sure that that's going to be a place where Matthew Stafford looks, despite the fact that Cooper Kupp won't be there.
Yeah, 10 catches. 112 yards for Nakua. Bigger receiver. He's about 6'2", so he's not your shifty little slot guy, but he played about 20 snaps in the slot, 40 outside. So yeah, we know Cooper Kupp does both. Cooper actually prefers lining up on the inside. He feels it gives him a little bit more leverage in, for his primary skill, which is route running. I mean, Cooper Kupp, not a burner, but he runs the best routes in the NFL. So 49ers don't have to deal with him. Instead, they have to deal with Nakua, who actually is the younger brother of Kai Nakua, former 49ers DB. Remember him? He was with the team in 2020, 2021, mainly a practice squad guy. So 49ers will see a relative of a former familiar face. The reason Kai Nakua left the 49ers in 2021 was actually, speaking of Robert Saleh and the Jets, they poached him off their practice squad in December of 2021. They signed him to the active roster. So anyway, that's just a little football is family kind of tangent. I think the way the 49ers defend this, though, is going to evolve as the season goes. I don't think that Steve Wilks was lying when he said that he wanted to mix and match his nickels. I would say, though, that the 49ers might have still been in a little bit of preseason mode as far as their substitution alignments. You have to remember, that was the first time that all 11 starters had played together on defense. And it could get pretty complicated when you're bringing in a different nickel for different body types at the slot receiver position. It's one of those things where you're on the sideline in the chaos of the moment. I think in week one, if you're not fully rehearsed on how you're going to do stuff in a game situation, I think in week one, you might want to simplify. And I think that's what the 49ers might have done. Whole half for Diamador Lenore in the slot, whole half for Isaiah Oliver in the slot. And I would think if they stay healthy enough to be able to run a mix and match, I would think that they'll delve further into one as the season progresses. That's just my read on it, because I don't think Steve Wilks had any reason to lie about the plans at that nickelback spot. I think he was remarkably actually open with those. And we saw both guys play, but we just saw them play by delineation of a half at that slot cornerback position. Why wouldn't you want to get more specific if you're the 49ers? I think that the only reason that would stop you is a logistical reason. You want to make sure those substitutions work seamlessly. That's probably something that we'll see develop as the season progresses.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Yeah, Puka Nakua, 15 targets on Sunday. That's a huge amount. He caught 10 of them for 119 yards. So no real deep ones, but you know that's the type of stat line that Cooper Kupp will have as well. Just to put 15 targets into perspective, Brandon Ayuk, monster game in Pittsburgh, he had 8 targets. So they went after, they went to Nacua, almost doubled that amount. So he's going to be somebody that Stafford's looking for. And I think, David, the big question for the Rams is, are they going, is Matthew Stafford going to have the time to kind of survey the field and find his open targets against a 49ers pass rush that was really good in Pittsburgh versus what they saw against the Seahawks? So,
yeah.
The Steve Wilks blitzing is a good question too, because obviously this just looking at those stats, you can tell that the Rams are doing what the Rams like to do, which is you have Stafford get rid of that ball very quickly. Not a big gain, not waiting for plays to develop, timing based, just like the 49ers, but that's how you thwart a really good pass rush. So I wonder whether Wilkes will hit the blitz a little bit more frequently than he did versus the Steelers.
Well, he did blitz frequently to begin the game. Remember, the first 7 plays, which was the first quarter, he blitzed on 4 of 7 snaps, and then he backed off. But they were up by 20 by the end of that, right? So it's one of those things where I don't think we have a big enough sample to know what the tendencies here are going to be, because he blitzed a lot, and then he backed off with a lead. And you're not going to get up 20 in every game that you play at this level. So might have been an unusual situation there. I will say, in terms of 49ers-Rams, there's a reason why the Rams have had ownership over the Seattle Seahawks, and there's a reason why the 49ers have had ownership over the Rams over the past few years. And it comes down to D-line versus O-line. The Seahawks just don't have a good pass rush. They haven't had a good pass rush here for a few years, and the Rams have been able to block them. And when Stafford has time, he'll carve you up. It doesn't matter who the receivers are. Matthew Stafford is a really, really good quarterback out of a clean pocket. The Rams in general haven't been able to block the 49ers defensive line. Even in years where the D-line hasn't been as great for the 49ers, they've still had a distinct advantage over the Rams offensive line, to the point where week 4 last year was one of the worst offensive line performances I have seen at this level. The Rams gave up 28 pressures against the 49ers. It was downright ugly. They went to quick release to an extreme in week 8 to avoid the same fate. They also had a better health situation in week 8, but the 49ers still beat them bad. And when a team does go to quick release, the way that we expect the Rams to go against this 49ers defensive line, there's a lot of pressure on the linebackers, on just coverage in general, back 7 in general, making sure that they choke off Stafford's first read. You can't have him snap and release. You have to make him double clutch. Or at least, you know, take a little bit longer to go to that first read. Reconsider, is that window one that I want to force the ball into? And the 49ers did a good job of that in week 8 last year. Because if you make that second hitch happen, that's when Bosa hits. That's when Hargrave hits. That's when Drake Jackson, who turned into TJ Watt last week, thanks to all the other attention everybody else was getting, that's when he hits. That's when Armstead could get his arms up in the pocket, get him into Stafford's eyes. And force an interception like he did last week. He got his big, big mitten up there right into Kenny Pickett's eyes, and he threw it to Charvarius Ward. Deontay Johnson slipped. That helped as well. So to me, it's a coverage fuels rush thing when it turns into a quick game. And the 49ers are going to see a whole lot of quick game this year because their pass rush is so good. This is probably going to be the first test. I mean, the Steelers' quick game last week was abysmal. I mean, Pickett got sped up from the second snap. They never found a rhythm, so they weren't able to establish anything. The Rams, you would think Stafford's more experienced. They've seen the 49ers. They have executed a quick game against them before. You'd think this is going to be a little bit of a bigger test for the 49ers. And I think that test really does start on the back end. They have to move the focal point of this game firmly to their defensive line. If you let the 49ers defensive line eat, if you set the table for them, they will eat, right? And that's what we've learned from 49ers-Rams matchups of the past.
We should note that Stafford's probably going to have to go to the silent count at times on Sunday, despite being in his home building, which helps the 49ers as well. Which has bothered Kelly Stafford to no end over the last couple of years as well. So, yeah, and that brings us to, you know, noting that I'm sure you heard this, but a couple of Steelers writers, guys who have been covering the Steelers for years, were really impressed by the amount of red they saw in the stadium. It's one thing when you see it, you know, against a bad team, like in Carolina last year. That one jumped out to me quite a bit. When you see it in a place like Pittsburgh, which A, has a really, really fantastic fan base, and they had a lot of hype coming out of the preseason too. I mean, I think a lot of Pittsburghians, and they probably still do, think that their team is going to be really good. And yet the 49ers showed up en masse like they did. That was impressive. I can only imagine that it's going to be even more so in Los Angeles on Sunday. And I thought that that was worth pointing out.
Yeah, I mean, I still remember week 18, 2021. That had to be 85% 49ers fans. And then Kelly Stafford went on the campaign to make sure that Rams fans didn't sell their tickets. That might have boosted it a little bit for the NFC title game. You might have seen 75-25 in that game, maybe 70-30 if we're going to be generous to the Rams. But the bottom line is that there are just more 49ers fans in the world and than there are Rams fans. And a big concentration of those 49ers fans happens to be in Southern California. And they get fired up because they could drive to a game in less than an hour. Well, I mean, that might be generous to L.A. traffic. Sometimes it'll take longer than an hour, but it's driving distance for both them and for the more ambitious fans from Northern California who can decide to head down I-5 or fly. If you head down I-5, you'd probably pull over in Kettleman City halfway, eat an In-N-Out burger. That's a tradition for those Southern California road trips. So, I mean, it's so geographically perfect for so many 49ers fans to go. And that stadium, by the way, I mean, every single time I step foot into SoFi, I'm blown away. It's going to take a few years for that one to feel old, I think, Matt. It's something, isn't it?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, it's got a sort of, Greek-Roman revival element to it. You feel like you're in some sort of forum, that there's something important going on in that arena. You know, it gets so much natural light. I wonder whether they could, you know, I don't know if they could grow grass for 365 days, but I wonder if they could get, enough quality grass in there. They might have to change it out a couple of times during the season. But I'm always wondering about which of these stadiums, like last year in Charlotte, for example, they have artificial turf. In Charlotte, North Carolina, which just gets sunshine and rain year-round, they should be able to grow really good turf in Charlotte, but they've got artificial. They should be able to do it in New York. That's an open-air stadium. It's places like Los Angeles and, you know, Seattle, some other ones that it's more of a question mark, but I wonder. But you're absolutely right. Minnesota and L.A., I think, have put themselves at the top of the heap as far as NFL stadiums.
Yeah, and the 49ers get to play in both of those this year. So SoFi is this week. And, you know, did the Rams hold Seattle? I haven't seen the final box score, but watching the tape, Seattle wasn't hardly able to do anything after halftime against that Rams defense. Like and they only had like 180 total yards to begin with. It might have been like under 30 yards in the second half. Like I just my gut feeling watching it. I'm going to go look at the box score here when I have the chance, but you know, we're talking all this about how the 49ers could snuff out the Rams offense, but this is going to be another test for Brock Purdy. And you know, I don't care who the other 10 guys are on defense. If 99 is out on the field, he's going to challenge the opposing quarterback in a direct way. And here's why. Aaron Donald lines up on the interior. There's nothing more devastating in the game of football than interior pressure to an opposing offense. If you get beaten clean on the interior, it doesn't matter who's quarterback. He doesn't have a chance to keep the play in structure. He might have a chance to be somebody like Lamar Jackson to sprint out And Brock Purdy's got Lamar Jackson's burst, by the way, with that 10-yard split. So maybe he can escape too. He might have a chance to, you know, pull a rabbit out of his hat and do a crazy play, but that's not sustainable. So somebody like Aaron Donald, when he's healthy, and he wasn't healthy for a lot of last year, but when he's healthy and he's disrupting the way that he can in the middle, that is the biggest game wrecker that there is. And yeah, the Rams, one of their corners, maybe their top corner this year, is Akello Witherspoon. That gives you an idea of how the talent has dropped off there. They don't have Jalen Ramsey anymore. They traded him away. As long as they have Donald, they have a chance to wreck a game. And to me, that's going to be another big test this week for Brock Purdy. It's a test that Geno Smith and the Seahawks failed last week, Matt.
Well, to answer your question, the Seahawks had 168 yards at halftime, and they
12?
Finished with 180.
So
they gained 12.
I was just watching the tape, and I was like, just my gut feeling was, wait, these guys aren't really moving the ball after halftime. And it was 12, huh?
Yeah, 12. So not a great second half for the old Seahawks. So, all right, that brings us to, you know, what we think happens. I mean, the Rams have been the get-right team for the 49ers. If the 49ers are struggling in the beginning of the season, usually they play the Rams, and, boy, they get right in a hurry. It's a different scenario going into this one. And you're right. The Aaron Donald thing is going to be really interesting. You noted it. Spencer Burford did not have a good game. I thought he was maybe a little bit too hyped up. I mean, you were there for the boom box exit onto the field. So the boom box comes out, and the two usual guys, Trent Williams and Deebo Samuel, are there. And the third guy there is Spencer Burford. And he's getting nice and hyped and excited for the game. The other two we know can kind of handle that amount of electricity, excitement. I wonder whether Burford, you know, going into his first year as the true starter, might have just gotten a little bit over his skis a bit, and whether this will be his personal get-right game. You know, maybe feeling a little bit bad for what happened in Pittsburgh, sees Aaron Donald on the slate and, you know, kind of has a bounce back game against him.
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait to go into the locker room tomorrow. I'm going to talk to Burford. I'm going to talk to McKivitz. That's what I'm going to be working on is, you know, offensive line. And I'm make a note that, you know, the O-line, D-line matchup is so big in this rivalry between the Niners and the Rams. We spent several minutes already talking about what this looks like going in the other direction in front of Matthew Stafford against Bosa, Hargrave and company. But, I mean, the 49ers, again, there was one weakness that was really pronounced, and it was the right side of the offensive line. And now that right side has to work against Aaron Donald. And it might not just be Spencer Burford working against Donald. Donald lines up at end. I mean, he does everything. He had a sack in week 6, 2019. Working against Justin School. And I think Justin School was playing right tackle, but don't quote me. It was School and Brunskill, two backup tackles for the 49ers at the Coliseum that afternoon. First drive, the Rams say, hey, you're playing with two backup tackles? Okay, we're going to put Aaron Donald in at end. He's going to be an edge rusher. Let's see how he handled this. And he beat Justin School clean for the sack. So, okay, the Rams saw Colton McKivitz struggle against T.J. Watt last week. They're going to line Aaron Donald up there. They're going to test him. There's going to be at least one time early in this game, like mark my words right now, there's going to be one time early in this game that Aaron Donald lines up against Colton McKivitz and the Rams say, here, how can you handle this? Guarantee it. So the 49ers are going to have to be ready for a lot of different combinations from the Rams. And, you know, I don't care who was on the other side, and I think that Geno Smith actually put together a nice season last year. The Seahawks have some weapons. If this defense held Seattle to 12 yards in the second half last year, it's a matchup the 49ers better take seriously, Matt.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the starting lineup for the Rams. It's not a real familiar one to us. They got a rookie, Byron Young, at one of the edge rusher spots, outside linebacker spots. As you noted, Akello Witherspoon is out there. Some guy named R. Yeast. I don't know who that is a starting safety. So it's a different group, but obviously they they came to play against against the Seahawks. However, I mean, I think you and I see eye to eye on this. The 49ers just have so much talent on both sides of the ball. I just can't see them losing this one. So I'm going to go 49ers 30, Rams 20 in this one.
Yeah, you know, I'm not convinced that the Rams can block the 49ers well enough to mount a sustained offensive attack. I think that one changed variable is what's going to change the Matt Stafford 330-yard performance into something that's a whole lot uglier. And, you know, maybe ends up with that many yards, but they won't be efficient ones against the 49ers. And, you know, there are two ways to neutralize the 49ers. One is to be able to run against them. And last week, the Rams were desperately trying to establish a run game against Seattle. They weren't really able to. They averaged, like, I think 2.6, somewhere between 2.5 and 3 yards per carry. It's not going to cut it.
2.3, yeah.
Oh, 2.3, wow. So even lower. It's not going to cut it against the 49ers. They got away with it against Seattle because their defense only gave up 12 yards in the second half and because Seattle doesn't have a pass rush, or at least not one that was able to challenge this version of the Rams O-line. I think we can confidently say that the 49ers pass rush is going to challenge the Rams O-line because they have in the last 9 meetings, you know, between these two teams. It's not going to change here in the 10th meeting. And so if the Rams can't run, which I don't expect them to be able to do against the 49ers, and if they can't challenge the 49ers pass rush, then it becomes a very different game than what we saw in the Pacific Northwest between the Rams and the Seahawks. And then the only question is, how is Brock Purdy and the 49ers 5 eligibles and McKivitz and Burford, how do they handle Donald and the Rams defense? But yeah, I mean, even if they do poorly, I think the 49ers just are relatively stronger on their defensive side of the ball in this matchup. So I got to pick the 49ers to win too. Based on what I mean, we were talking up the Steelers defense last week, and I think that's still going to be a good unit. But the 49ers are in juggernaut mode this year, Matt. I really think so. I mean, it kind of verifies everything that we talked about this offseason about building this roster, making sure QB would be healthy, and then having that QB just play point guard and it being really hard to defend. And I think they could score their points against the Rams. I think they're going to win this one. Yeah, I'll say 27-17. What do you think?
Okay.
I know what you think, but what do you think about my prediction?
No, I like that. I mean, look at how the 49ers-Steelers game began with 5 3-and-outs by the Steelers. The Rams had 1 3-and-out against the Seahawks, and they had, I'm just looking at their drive chart, they had 1 16-play possession, 110, 109, 114, and they finished with a pair of 9. So that's how they won. They just dominated the ball, the time of possession. Let's see what the time of possession was. Oh, look at that. 39-23 versus 20-37. I mean, the 49ers didn't even do that against the Steelers. So that's the formula for beating the 49ers, is to have these long, excruciating, grueling drives, which keep the ball out of Brock Purdy's hands and Christian McCaffrey's hands. That's the question. Will they be able to do that against a much better defense? Both you and I say no, they won't. But I think that's how they're going to try to attack it. We'll see on Sunday. We'll come at you next week at this time to wrap up the Rams and to talk about the Giants. It's going to be a short week. To me, David, that's interesting in itself, because I don't know whether they will give Nick Bosa the full allotment of snaps, given the fact that he's still sort of recovering from the fact that he held out for so long and didn't have a training camp, and will have a short week to prepare for the Giants. So I'm guessing it's going to be around 35, maybe 35 to 40 for this game. But that'll be one of the things for us to keep an eye on Sunday.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of a count to keep this as sustainable as possible for the 49ers. And then obviously the quick turnaround. I think that means they only get one practice, right, before the Giants, because you have Monday off after the game. They'll probably practice on Tuesday. They'll probably be very, very light. And then you're walking through already on Wednesday. You probably walk through and fly to LA. I think that's how it's going to work for the 49ers. So, I'm flipping games around. I thought they were playing the Giants first, the Rams. No, I know they're playing the Rams this weekend, but the game against the Giants is at home. So you don't have to fly. They're going to have to do that against Seattle this year for Thanksgiving. Right. It'll be a Thursday turnaround. So anyway, it's a crammed week. You have to manage it right. The good news is that you have a longer week on the back end, and you also have the Arizona Cardinals in the back end. And so if you win this game and you're the 49ers, because the Giants have to play you on a short week too, and the Giants have to fly cross country, 49ers should be relatively heavy favorites for that. If you can win down in LA, you're talking about a potential 4-0 start heading into Cleveland for the 49ers. I don't think it's too early to talk about that, because that's just how the schedule lines up. And the big picture here to sign off, I think we should say, Matt, is that everything the 49ers are doing right now needs to be geared toward getting the one seed. In 2021, they ran out of gas because they didn't have the one seed. In 2022, they had to play Philly on the road, and that had a big, big part of why Brock Purdy got hurt. I mean, they were able to pin their ears back in the pass rush with the crowd roaring. Those dynamics are different if you're the road team than if you're the home team for the Eagles. So I think the number one seed needs to be the 49ers' goal. So talking about starting 4-0 and doing all that stuff, to me, that's significant, because that's all part of giving yourself the inside track to get that one seed.
Yeah, and it's a departure from last year. They were 3-4. They put themselves behind the eight ball to start out with, and it was a real uphill battle to win that one seed. They didn't get it. They had to go to Philly. I think they'd love to have Philly come this way in January this time. That would be poetic, let's just say. All right, well, that's it for us. We will get back to you at some point before the Giants game. We may have to alter our schedule as well, but we will let you know when we're going to have another live room. For David Lombardi, this is Matt Barrows. We'll talk to you next week.